Chapter 12. The following morning, Mirko sent Fionnthan and the twins off to negotiate for smoked fish and wine to bring back to Sleaty. Then he and Dunica sought out the new building which housed the harbour controller. They identified themselves to two bodyguard enforcers who were engaged in a board game in an outer room and were escorted to the space curtained off for the officer. The officer's main tasks were to tax cargoes passing through the harbour and to keep his master informed of the comings and goings by ship. But he confirmed that he also took an interest in Kuala history. When he heard of their research, he told them there were at least three people they should see. The first and nearest, he said, was a hermit scholar named Shannon, who lived only a few miles away along the coast to the south. After that, they should continue southwards to the house of the Tuath king. There they would find two knowledgeable people, a poet called Muirchertach and a scholar by the name of Swivne. Outside by the shore, Mirko came upon a familiar figure, a master fisherman and coastal trader, Fardarcha, who had been a close friend of Mirko's father. He was delighted to welcome Mirko back. "Of course I remember you," he said, "and your father too. He used to know by instinct where the best fishing was. He'd share his knowledge and we all benefited from it. He was one of us, in spite of his strange northern accent." Mirko told him they wanted to visit places that had been important to Patrick in Brega, Ullagh and beyond. "We need to go by boat, leaving in a few days' time," he said. "We'd pay well, and I'd like to sail with someone I know and could trust, like yourself. Would you be interested?" Fardarcha asked a few questions. "How many people? How much baggage? When do they expect to return?" When he had his answers, 3, not much, 4 to 6 weeks, he named a reasonable price and agreed to take them, starting in 2 days' time. Pleased that the arrangement was made, Mirko called Fionnthan back with the ox cart, and with all 5 aboard, they headed south to visit the hermit Shannon. Following the coast road, they arrived at a scattered cliff-top settlement and saw Shannon's small house as it had been described to them, inland a little and set in a grove of wind-blown oaks. As they drew near, they could hear voices from the house. Through the open door, they saw the thin white-haired hermit seated on a chair. He was speaking to 2 young boys who were looking at a tattered book open on a desk. Shannon called to them, "Visitors are welcome, but please rest yourselves on the bench outside the door until this lesson is over." Mirko and Dunica sat in the sun to wait, while Fionnthan and the twins went off to water the oxen and explore the area. Birdsong and the distant sound of the sea were soporific, but Mirko had not forgotten their quest. "Dunica," said the master scriptor, "let's rehearse the questions we need to ask here." Dunica concentrated. "First, where did Palladius land and why did his mission fail? Second, where did Patrick land when he came on his mission? Was it here? Third, the ship that Patrick escaped on, where did it go? Fourth, is the story of Mount Thorn true? Fifth, anything else relevant that Shannon may know, either new to us or already known, and thus confirming the accuracy of his knowledge?" "Very good," said Mirko. They fell silent and listened to the voices from inside the house. Shannon was giving a scripture lesson. He would refer each pupil in turn to a particular verse of the Gospels and have him read it, gently correcting him as necessary. Then he would explain and comment on the verse. Mirko listened, impressed. The hermit was deftly applying the Gospel message to the situations his pupils might meet in their daily lives. Soon the lesson ended. As the boys came out, they stopped to bow politely to the clerics before hurrying away. Shannon invited his visitors to enter. Mirko introduced himself and Dunica as seekers of information about Patrick and Palladius. He paused when he noticed the hermit was looking not at them, but between them. Then he saw the milky eyes and realized Shannon was blind. "You are surprised," said the hermit, smiling. "Many people are. But when the Lord closes one door, he opens another. I'm gifted with a keen memory and I keep it exercised. Both my grandfathers had this ability too, and they passed on many traditions to me, separately, because unfortunately they didn't get on very well with each other. So ask me your questions and I'll gladly tell you what I can." He listened carefully to what Mirko had to say, then gave his answers. "First about Palladius. Both my grandfather said he landed near here, at Invernea. He hadn't come with a specific mission to convert. The Pope, it appeared, had sent him to minister to the few Christians who were already in the region. An ancestor of mine was one. Palladius travelled around Leinster and founded a few churches, but he met a lot of opposition from Druids and kings. They thought Christianity would cause difficulties with their slaves, and it often did. And of course, the Druids felt threatened by a new religion. The poets didn't like the idea of turning the other cheek either. It didn't lend itself to rousing epics. One of my grandfathers had been told that Palladius was an elderly man, not very forceful in character and in delicate health. My other grandfather hadn't heard that, but merely that Palladius was opposed and even attacked so that he got discouraged. Afterwards, they both said he went back to Britain within 12 months and died there shortly after arriving, in the year before Patrick came. Your second question was about Patrick's arrival. I regard it as definite that he landed here at Invernahia. Neither of my grandfathers was in any doubt about that. He only stayed a few days, but during that time he talked to my ancestor, among other people. Then he set off northwards along the coast in his ship with the group of companions who had accompanied him from Britain. Now here's where my grandfathers differed. One had heard only that Patrick went to Inverculpa in Brega on his way to Tara. But the other said he had been told more, that Patrick's plan was to go first to the north, to Slemish, where he had been a slave, before going to Brega. This was so that he could compensate his previous master for the loss of his services, and also to convert him if possible. To me that has the ring of truth, because Patrick was known to be very punctilious about paying his way, so as to be in debt to no one. And he was also completely single-minded about spreading the good news of salvation. You ask where Patrick went when he escaped on the ship crewed by pagans. Now there I really can't help you. Nobody takes much notice of a poor young man finding a last-minute passage on a ship, not unless someone is pursuing him, and we know of no pursuit in Patrick's case. Neither do we know of anything he might have told my ancestor about the ship's destination. But as you know, most ships would be going to Britain. Also, Patrick tells us in the Confessio, which I read long ago before I lost my sight, that the voice he heard when he was a slave said he would be going to his homeland. And further on in the Confessio, he speaks of Britain as his homeland. I don't know how he and his shipmates could have spent 3 days crossing to Britain and then travelled through a deserted area for 28 days. Perhaps they were delayed and blown off course by a storm and landed in some very remote region where they wandered around lost. But those are really only guesses. We thank you for them all the same, Father Shannon, said Mirko. Donica, you are noting those points?
I certainly am, Father.
Donica had indeed been scribbling away rapidly in his tiniest script, having decided that words on tablets were more reliable than the cupboards of the memory house. There are a few blank tablets here if you need them, my son, the hermit said kindly, turning his blind gaze towards Donica. Now, he went on, you had a question about Monthon. There is a church dedicated to him and probably founded by him some distance south of here. My grandfathers knew Monthon was a nickname, though they didn't seem to know his real name. They both said he was one of those who came with Patrick, that he was involved in a row with some druids and that a mob had collected, and that he then went off with Patrick, but returned years later and founded that church. Where they differed was about how he lost his teeth. One said he heard someone knock them out with a stone during the brawl here. The other grandfather said no stones were thrown during the row, and Monthon was probably gap-toothed already when he arrived. Frankly, I don't know what the truth of it is. Mirko made a mental note that the Monthon story was something that could be left out of his life of Patrick. There was nothing particularly uplifting about it, and there was doubt about the central point. On the other hand, the information about Palladius and Patrick had been very useful. His thoughts were interrupted by the arrival of two women from the settlement, bringing food and drink for Shannon. They offered to supply the two visitors also, but Mirko knew that those people were not well off and thought it best to decline. He and Donica thanked the hermit again for his help and took their leave. The ox cart and its crew were nearby. Fionthon had refilled their water flasks from a stream. This, with cheese and bread, was their midday meal. Then they continued their journey southwards until they reached the Tuath King's residence. This was a substantial roundhouse without buildings, protected by a high enclosing ditch. The gatekeeper admitted them at once. At the house they were met by the Rachtere, a corpulent, fussy man, who made a great business of establishing their identity and the reason for their visit. No, no, impossible to see the poet today, he told them. The king is away with the King of Leinster on a raid against the Dacia, and Murkatuk is lying in a darkened house composing a victory poem for our king's return. He can't be disturbed today, and probably not tomorrow either.
Donnacha's inquiring mind suddenly got the better of him. "But suppose the king is not victorious," he asked. The Rakthara smiled patronizingly. "It would be too much to expect monks to understand about poetry, I suppose," he said. "If the king's victory were, let us say, less than complete, only the last two or three verses would need to be changed. They would then celebrate how the king, though let down by his allies, fought his way heroically through the enemy ranks and came home to the acclaim of his people." "But if the king were killed?" "That too would require a change only in the last few verses. They would recount how the king's severed head vowed vengeance on his enemies and how his son would avenge him." "And how old is his son?"
3. "But of course the king won't lose. Why should he? He's never lost a battle before."
"Has he ever been in a battle before?"
Mirko decided to intervene before the Rakthara became too irritated to be helpful.
"Since Murkertook is unavailable, we would like, if possible, to speak with the scholar Swivna."
"Yes, yes, I'll see if that can be arranged," said the Rakthara, hurrying off and leaving them standing there.
And there they stood for almost half an hour, while servants bustled around, dogs were chased out, and slaves swept the floor and laid down fresh rushes. Finally, the Rakthara reappeared.
"Well, well, he's a very busy man, the scholar. Yes, yes, always working, but he'll see you now for a short time. Mind now, a short time."
And he led them through a passage to where Swivna rose from his desk to greet them cordially. He was a serious-looking youngish man with sharp features, his dark hair streaked with grey.
"We've been told your time is limited," said Mirko, "so we'll try not to take up too much of it."
"Is that what the Rakthara told you? Well, it's nonsense. Take as long as you need. That man's an idiot. First tell me about yourselves."
Mirko performed the introductions, explained that they were seeking information on Patrick and Palladius, and listed their specific questions.
"Yes," said Swivna, "I see." Then he spent a silent moment collecting his thoughts.
"I'm sure you'll want to know the sources for my knowledge of those matters," he went on. "Any good researcher would. So I should explain that about 180 years ago, annals began to be kept in this territory. The Tuath king of the time was an enthusiast for history and learning, it seems. He commissioned a set of annals from the monks of our local monastery. He told his Olive, my long-ago predecessor, to keep him informed about the progress of the work. All sorts of events were recorded, including some from before the annals were begun. Some guesswork there, I think. There were references to raids, wars, deaths of kings and abbots, plagues, comets, eclipses, even whales dying on beaches, everything the annalists down the years thought particularly notable. I'm keeping in touch with current work on the annals, of course. But 3 years ago, there was a disaster. A novice knocked over a lamp and panicked. A fire started, and the only two copies of the annals were burnt. So part of my work is helping the monks to reconstruct as much as we can from memory and from rescued pieces of scorched vellum. That's my main source. But as a scholar, I'm aware too of the more reliable traditions held by other scholars I have contacts with.
What a noble task, exclaimed Donnacha, reconstructing the facts of the past.
Not as noble as you think, perhaps, said Swivna, smiling. Rather humdrum, really. I've heard a good description of it from our bishop here, a very devout and intelligent man. He saw those facts as being like stone flags on the floor or the surface of roads, something to keep your feet clean and stop you sinking too deep into the mud of ignorance as you travel through life. But the work of those who write about the saints, as I assume you will be doing, is more significant, he said. It erects signposts pointing the way to eternal happiness and with Holy Scripture lighting them up so that all can read them.
Very true and very illuminating, Swivna, murmured Mirko. Even if the writers of the saints' lives may often be less worthy than the analysts.
Donnacha, please note what we've just been told.
Already done, Father.
Now, as to your questions, Swivna resumed. Palladius landed at Invernea and left again within the year.
Why?
Because of discouragement. Maybe illness contributed to discouraging him. We've no definite evidence on that. But the opposition he seems to have met would have been discouragement enough. It's likely, too, that he couldn't speak Irish or only a few words, so he'd have had to preach through an interpreter. Hard to do effectively. Patrick landed at Invernea also. He knew Irish well and had a mission to convert, not just a minister to the few Christians who were here already. He was full of zeal and totally confident that God would help him to do God's work. Patrick left very soon to sail north along the coast, and there's good evidence that he had intended to go and see his old master in Dal Norida before doubling back to Inverculpa and Tara. Nobody knows where Patrick boarded the ship that carried him away from slavery,
probably south of here if it really was 200 miles from Slemish. There's no certainty either about where the ship went, but it's reasonable to believe it went to Britain. As for Monthon and the stone-throwing story, that's just a piece of unreliable folklore. There was a gap-toothed priest with that nickname in Patrick's time, but he could have lost his teeth anywhere. Those are the answers I can give you, and I wish you every success in your quest. Clearly the interview had come to an end. Mirko asked Swivne if he thought they should stay on for a day to see Murkertuk the poet. I doubt he'll be available tomorrow either, the analyst told him. He's been known to spend 3 days on a poem. Anyway, I don't think he could tell you any more than I have, though he might express it more poetically. On the way out, Mirko and Donnacha again met the Rochtere. He invited them, with a marked lack of enthusiasm, to stay the night, and seemed quite pleased when they declined. The ox cart awaited them outside the enclosure. As they walked towards it, Mirko turned to his assistant. Donnacha, did you think that conversation was useful? Yes, Father Mirko, although it told us little or nothing that we hadn't heard before. It was highly important because it was independent confirmation of what we heard from the hermit, and I'd say those are two highly reliable sources. Very good, Donnacha, my own opinion exactly. You wouldn't like to take over my job, would you? God forbid, exclaimed Donnacha, appalled. Only joking, son, only joking. Rejoining Fionnthon, Oscar and Oisin, they retraced their route as far as the cliff-top settlement. By then it was almost dusk and a fine drizzle of rain had begun to fall. They decided to erect their leather tents and camp near the settlement for the night, buying some supplies from the local people. In the morning they resumed their journey towards Invernahia. Oscar explained that at the harbour the day before he had got two offers of smoked fish in the quantities the abbot wanted. He had inspected the stores. Both lots were of good quality. One was a low-priced offer, but they would have to wait a week for the full quantity, while the second was a little dearer, but would be ready the following day. Take the second one, Mirko told him. Abbot A wouldn't want a long delay. What about the wine? Oscar produced two tiny flasks. I had these samples from the only merchant who has wine in stock at the moment, he said. The one with the markings is a little below what I think is the usual price. The other one is half as dear again. I wouldn't know which is better. Mirko took the flasks and tasted wine from each. The wine from the marked flask he spat out at once. That's really rough. The second flask was a good deal better. Buy that unmarked one, Oscar, but only half the quantities we had in mind. He passed Oscar the rings and brooches he'd need for his purchases. Oisin, with Fionnthon, would be the one to bring the merchandise back to Sleaty, Oscar explained. He himself, because he was the eldest and the bravest, he said, winking at Donnacha, would be the bodyguard travelling in the boat. Eldest by 5 minutes, maybe, said Oisin, laughing. And would you care to step down so that we can test who's the bravest? Enough of that, lads, Mirko intervened. But Donnacha whispered to him that Oisin would really prefer to go back to Sleaty because he had a girlfriend on the estate there. It was well into the afternoon when the cart rattled and jolted into Invernahia. There they found that Fardurka, the boat owner, needed the following day to complete his arrangements, but would be ready to leave at dawn on the day after. He would bring his son, Con, already an experienced sailor, to assist him. I'm an experienced sailor too, you know, Mirko told him, even if I'm a little out of practice. In your teenage years you were, and I might even let you hold the tiller for a while. But you and Brother Donnacha will be going off with young Oscar and leaving me to wait with the boat. I don't want to guard it on my own. That night Fardurka lodged Mirko and Donnacha at his home, as well as providing feed for the oxen, while Fionnthon and the twins slept in the tents. The next day they loaded the purchases for Sleaty and assembled supplies for the boat journey. Mirko composed a message for Abbot A, summarising the results of their visit to Kula. Donnacha inscribed it on a tablet which he gave to Fionnthon. By mid-morning, Fionnthon and Oisin were ready to start out on the return journey across the hills to Sleaty. Mirko had some parting words for them. Be sure to tell our abbot that we're well and cheerful and about to undertake our sea voyage, much as Patrick did, it seems. And tell him that if he agrees, we'd like you to be back here waiting for us 4 weeks from today and to wait another 2 weeks if necessary. If we're later than that, we'll find some other way of getting back to Sleaty. In the hills, keep watch in turn if you're camping out at night. The risk of bandits is low at this season, but it's best to be vigilant. Then he gave them his blessing, and he, Donnacha, and Oscar watched the ox cart set off.